Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today on Change Surfer Radio, I'll be talking with Tony Fleming from the World Federalist Association. The WFA promotes transnational democratic solutions to world problems and is ever more vital now in this time of unilateral Bush administration empire building. And then I'll be talking with Dr. Thomas Georges, the author of Digital Soul, Intelligent Machines and Human Values, which addresses about 20 of the most important questions about the coming of artificial intelligence. So stay tuned for another exciting edition of Change Surfer Radio. Speaking now with Tony Fleming. Tony Fleming is the Membership Communications Coordinator for the World Federalist Association, an organization promoting democratic transnationalism and the strengthening of democratic transnational bodies. Welcome, Tony.
Thanks, Jay. I appreciate the opportunity to speak today.
Tell us a little bit about the history of the World Federalists.
The World Federalists were started back in 1947, although there were some earlier versions of it. Many of the initial members were veterans returning from World War II, optimistic college students, broad assortment across the political spectrum of people who felt that we'd reached a point where war was simply not an option anymore for us, particularly with the advent of the atomic bomb. Many of them felt that the UN was a great start, but felt that it needed some strengthening in order to live up to its mandate to end war and represent we the peoples.
Now, back at that time, there were a number of different groups advocating world government. And were the World Federalists seen as a part of that group, or were they seen as a more moderate body?
Well, I think it's true that we were seen as an organization that was promoting world government. We did start off as a political organization, and there was a great deal of interest in setting up a federal system of world government. At the time, both members of Congress, many state legislatures passed resolutions to that effect. It was a very popular topic coming out of World War II. Our goals today are a little bit more nuanced than that, not so much for world government as a complete package, but strengthening those international institutions that can be tied together and integrated in a form that would provide a democratic system of global governance.
How are you different from the UN Association?
The UN Association is strong supporters of the United Nations system. Historically, they have been promoters of the UN, as have we. I think that World Federalists, however, have been a little bit more outspoken in recognizing some of the deficits that the UN system has, including lack of democracy, an imbalance in power as far as the Security Council goes. So we've been a little bit more critical of the UN, although we do support it as a system.
So the World Federalists advocate abolishing the Security Council or getting rid of the permanent members? Or
no, I don't think that abolishing the Security Council is called for. I do believe that there needs to be a review of how it is, how it's constructed, how it's constituted. The U.S. Security Council set up today reflects the real politic of the world 50 years ago, as opposed to the way it is today. I don't know if there are specific recommendations that have any weight at present as far as reforming the Security Council. I do know that the veto is a primary concern to many people, and I know that we are exploring various options on how we can make the Security Council a little bit more attuned to today's needs and a little bit more representative of the international community.
What are some of the other critiques that you have of the current UN? I mean, I presume that you have a more interesting critique than the one that the Bush administration has, which is basically, I've starved my kid in the basement for 20 years and he still can't learn to read. You know, the Bush administration says this UN can't accomplish anything when it's been systematically, it and its allies, it's been systematically defunding it and ignoring it. So what are some of the other critiques? Are you critical of the bloat, the waste, some of the other things that people say about it?
Well, the UN is like any bureaucracy. You know, our own Congress, many international corporations have, overspending some members that are not as conscientious of cost and so forth. But But that's not a reason to starve the UN or reject it outright. Some changes based on U.S. demands have been met, and they've been met quickly, and they've been met effectively. The institution of a UN Inspector General at the UN, which cleaned up a good deal of the UN's accounting problems, was at the assistance of the UN at the U.S. Unfortunately, the U.S. hasn't lived up, or infrequently lived up, to its promises to then start paying its dues. We didn't pay our dues, I believe, in full until after 9/11, when all of a sudden it seemed like our members of Congress realized that we needed international cooperation and we needed to pay our dues to the international body.
And then promptly forgot it again.
Probably so.
Tell us a little bit about the history of the ICC. This is an idea, as I understand it, has been floating around, of having an international criminal court. Mm-hmm. Been floating around for many, many decades. And we have a tendency, people of my political persuasion, have a tendency to look fondly back on the Clinton administration, ignoring the fact that they were as culpable in a lot of these crimes as anybody else. Tell us about how did the Clinton eventually come about to sign the ICC? What happened with Bush? Where is it going from here?
The history of the ICC...
And tell us what it is, too.
Sure. The International Criminal Court is the first permanent tribunal at the global level that is empowered and strengthened to a point where it can try individual criminals. Many global activists sometimes confuse this with the ICJ, which is the International Court of Justice, or more commonly known as the World Court. The World Court can try disputes between governments, but it cannot try individual perpetrators. The ICC was set up to fix that gap in the international community. Many of your listeners will probably remember the Nuremberg trials, in which we prosecuted individual Nazi perpetrators of genocide and war crimes. At the time the World Federalists were set up, we wanted to make that type of court permanent, because we knew that genocide was a concern in many of the colonial territories, and probably would become more so. Unfortunately, the political will wasn't behind that. It didn't happen until early 90s, when the Yugoslav massacre and the Rwanda massacre broke out on the international scene, that people realized we did need a permanent court to handle this, because setting up ad hoc tribunals is akin to building a fire department whenever there's a fire, rather than having one ready to put out the flames. By the time the ad hoc tribunals got up and running, evidence was lost, witnesses had been coerced, and it was very difficult to reach justice in those cases. The permanent tribunal is able to investigate accusations of war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. Very specific, very limited in its jurisdiction, but empowered to go after witnesses, evidence, and bring perpetrators to trial. Have to probably disagree with some of your members in regards, or some of your listeners in regards to the Clinton view on international justice. While much better than the current administration, Clinton only signed the treaty on the very last day that it was open for signature in order to keep the U.S. government involved in negotiations. That was December 31st, 2000. And unfortunately, at the time that he signed it, he also stated that he didn't believe the U.S. government should ratify it, because he felt there were still flaws in the treaty. We've been working with a number of NGOs here in D.C., the World Federalist, through a group that we set up, the Washington Working Group on the International Criminal Court, to provide talking points and fact sheets on the ICC, illustrate how it would be in the best interest of the U.S. government to ratify and become a full partner in pursuing global justice. But as you're well aware, it's been an uphill battle.
Now, the principal complaint that people in the U.S. Administrations have had is that American soldiers and State Department officials potentially could be charged in this court for war crimes in, as a part of our establishment of Pax Americana. What are the guarantees that won't happen when it's not warranted? And how are we different from anybody else in that regard? I mean, why wouldn't people who hate the Dutch take the Dutch into court as well?
There are a number of checks and balances in the ICC treaty, many of them based on the U.S. Bill of Rights. In fact, that's not something that's commonly known. Before any individual could come before the ICC in a trial, the government of his nationality would have first try at investigating and prosecuting them for war crimes. And as we can easily admit, the U.S. military system is probably the most intense at investigating its own and bringing criminals to trial. Another problem that we're facing, though, with Americans coming before an international court is the protection of civil liberties when there is not an international court available to us. Americans traveling abroad are frequently reminded the Constitution does not travel with you. If you commit a crime and you're apprehended in a foreign country, unless there's an agreement with the U.S. government, you'll stand trial in that foreign court. The ICC actually provides much more protection to Americans, particularly military personnel, because automatically they come before trial before a U.S. court. Only if the U.S. fails to live up to do a good faith investigation of charges would the ICC jurisdiction be invoked.
I'm speaking with Tony Fleming. He works with the World Federalist Association. I'm Dr. Jay, and this is Change Surfer Radio. We're talking about strengthening of transnational institutions. The Bush administration was convinced at the last minute last summer by Colin Powell to go before the UN and ask the UN's permission, except what didn't turn out to be that way, to wage this war in Iraq, and then didn't get it, and then went to war in Iraq anyway, pissing off the entire world and all of our European allies, even the ones who reluctantly have backed this adventure. This must be a pretty depressing time for advocacy organizations like the WFA, who have been trying to move the transnational democracy agenda forward, and this has set it back. Or do you, like my old mentor, Michael Harrington, see some kind of dialectical opportunity here? I mean, there's a hell of a lot more attention being paid to transnational democracy, and I think a lot of people are seeing the need, as the Bush administration said, you know, if it's not going to be a democratic solution, then it has to be Pax Americana.
I think I would agree with the latter. I think this is a time in which more Americans than ever are conscious of what the UN is about and what role it is supposed to play in international affairs. More people are asking questions about war as an entity itself, not just this war that we're currently engaged in, but war as a tool that nations use to further their own interest, and questioning whether or not that is still valid. I mean, these are many questions that led to the founding of the UN, led to the founding of the WFA organization 50 years ago. And we're seeing again that there was an optimistic moment there when Bush did go to the UN. And he did properly note that it was the UN's responsibility to hold Saddam accountable for violations of Security Council resolutions. We were hoping that that was a new start, that was a turning around of the Bush administration's view towards international accountability. Unfortunately, the UN was unable to reach consensus on how to enforce its decisions and deal with Saddam. And admittedly, Saddam has violated many UN resolutions. He is a dictator and has oppressed his people. The question is, how do you deal with that? And it's unfortunate that the UN was unable to reach consensus on how to do so, but it's also unfortunate the U.S. felt it had to go outside the UN system and use military action against Saddam.
There's a view that Tony Blair is actually going to be Bush's better nature here. He's trying to get the UN, he's trying to get the U.S. to agree to bring the UN in to administer a post-war Iraq. And there have been noises from the Blair administration that Saddam Hussein and his senior officials would be taken before the ICC, even though the U.S. refuses to recognize it. Where do you see the politics of that going?
I see it very unlikely that a case could be made in taking Bush before the ICC at this point.
Not the Bush, Saddam. I mean, Bush I'd be willing to see before the ICC as well. No, Saddam.
Saddam could be brought before the court on four crimes that occurred following the court's coming into operation, which was last July. Unfortunately, for crimes which took place before that, gassing of the Kurds and numerous other human violations that we know about, those took place before the court came into operation, and so he would not be able to come before the ICC. However, there is a possibility, and I know there's discussions about setting up an ad hoc tribunal to try Saddam. I'm not sure how that's going to play out, because there is some concern about U.S. government being complicit in some of those crimes. We don't know to the extent of that. We don't know if those are merely rumors. But we know that the U.S. government would take a strong stand on whether this court would be allowed to go forward, primarily because this court, an ad hoc tribunal, would have to be set up by the U.N. Security Council, on which the U.S. government has a veto.
Well, yeah, we know how that will go. The World Federalist Association, is it growing? How can people plug into its activities? We have a local chapter here in Mansfield, Connecticut, but our show goes all over the U.S. and all over the world. So speak to the global Federalist movement as well. Is there a global movement, and how can people plug in?
Sure. There are World Federalist organizations in over 30 countries today, and we coordinate our efforts through the World Federalist Movement Secretariat Office in New York City. And their website is www.worldfederalist.org. And from there, you can click on who the WFM is and what countries have member organizations. As far as Americans who wish to participate in this, our website is www.wfa.org. And you can sign up for action alerts as well as a monthly e-zine, which goes out, Federalist Action, that will give you monthly action alerts on what you can do. This month we're launching the Victims Trust Campaign for the International Criminal Court. This was a campaign set up with Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, a number of other organizations that looks at what the true purpose of that International Criminal Court is. It's not merely to enforce international law, but it's to protect the victims of genocide and war crimes. And the way we're promoting that is to ask members to send $5, a $5 check made out to the Victims Trust Campaign, Victims Trust Fund, I'm sorry, to their senator with instructions to send it on to the Victims Trust Fund on their behalf. There are only two responses that the senator can do. He can either return it to the constituent or he can forward it on as instructed. Either way, the message will be heard that Americans support the ICC, we support global justice, and we want the U.S. government to get behind it. So we encourage all of your listeners, whether global or American, to log on to WFA.org or VictimsTrustFund.org and sign up for that campaign.
One more question about the ICC. The ICC, after it was created, the Congress, this Republican-led Congress, passed a law, as I understand it, which says that any American who's held in the ICC, in The Hague, that U.S. troops will be used to liberate them from this unjust trial, and that when the ICC was actually inaugurated recently, they had little sandbags around all the flags that were in front of it and little cardboard soldiers to protect against U.S. invasion. Is this true?
I haven't heard that, but that's an amusing story. I'd like to find out if that is true. What this is, the legislation was commonly referred to as the Hague Invasion Act. On the floor of Congress, a member who was in favor of the ICC had a map drawn up showing how the U.S. plan is to invade The Hague in case one of our soldiers was brought before trial. It was quite an amusing scenario, and it really gave the U.S. a bad image in how it sought to impose its will in the international community by invading a court of law with military force.
I don't think it's nearly as amusing a story now after we've treated France and Europe in general and Turkey the way that we have in the course of this war. Mm-hmm. I mean, the prospect of increasing confrontation between the European Union and the United States seems increasingly likely.
Yeah, I've heard that that many of our former allies are looking at military arrangements and not having Britain or the U.S. participate in those in ways that would be used to further justice, at least in the European sphere.
It's a very depressing time in that respect, but as you say, there may be a lot of opportunities here for pressing ahead. I've been speaking with Tony Fleming. He's with the World Federalist Association, which promotes transnational democratic solutions and can be found at WFA.org. Thanks so much for joining us today, Tony.
Sure, I appreciate the opportunity.
We'll be right back with Dr. Thomas Georges. He's the author of Digital Soul, Intelligent Machines, and Human Values, which looks at the many ethical and political problems which will be created by artificial intelligence. I'm speaking now with Dr. Thomas Georges. Dr. Georges is a former research scientist with the National Bureau of Standards and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and he's recently, in his retirement, written Digital Soul, Intelligent Machines and Human Values. Now that you've had the opportunity to look into artificial intelligence, what kind of timing do you ascribe to it? Is it near? Is it far? Is it possible at all?
Well, it's here now. There's a good example I can cite of artificial intelligence, an expert system. It's coming up on income tax time, so you may be using TurboTax to do your income taxes. That's a good example of an expert system, which is one kind of artificial intelligence. Investment companies are already using intelligent machines to pick stocks and manage portfolios. And you can see in the Pentagon, for example, they're automating everything out of sight, so everything works without much human intervention. And even in our daily lives, every time you use a ATM machine or make an online airplane reservation, you're interacting with an intelligent machine. So it's there already, and it's just a matter of time before they get smarter than we are, and perhaps even start thinking about taking over.
As you note in the book, there is a debate about whether intelligence can be replicated, and in particular, a human type of intelligence can be replicated. One of the debates that I think is more cogent, I agree with you that I think it's inevitable, but I think the alienness of machine-based intelligence is going to be so profoundly different from organic intelligence or mammalian intelligence. We can't even communicate with dolphins. I wonder what your reflections are on whether you think, you talk about whether computers can have emotions, whether they can become neurotic. That seems to be a heavy kind of anthropomorphic expectation about the way that this is going to turn out.
Yeah. Well, there's a persistent but illogical argument against AI that goes something like this. I've never seen a machine that can do so-and-so, for example, be intelligent or have emotions or be conscious, and therefore no machine could ever do so. And that's not a completely logical argument. There are lots of things that can't be done now, but people are able to imagine them in the future. And our machines so far are capable of only primitive self-awareness, self-monitoring, self-repair, for example, because they haven't been priorities in their design. But if you try to compare machines with organic machines like us, on the other hand, we've evolved and survived for eons because natural selection strongly rewards abilities like self-repair and self-monitoring, which are related to consciousness. And so as our machines become more complex and difficult for us to understand, the ones without these abilities will just fall by the wayside, and in humans these traits are have become what we call consciousness and intelligence, but by the same kind of natural selection that gave rise to us, machines will have to be more self-aware and intelligent in order to survive.
This is Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and I'm speaking today with Dr. Thomas Georges. He's the author of Digital Soul, Intelligent Machines and Human Values from Westview Press. One of the questions that you raise in your book, Dr. Georges, is whether machines will ever be held culpable for crimes or for misdemeanors or just as citizens in general. And you point out that there's the same question about human beings. Some human beings, the insane and so forth, are not held culpable. Under what conditions would both machines or humans, should they be held culpable? What kinds of autonomy would they require to be held accountable for their actions?
Well, culpability really means blame. And the traditional view of morality says that there is an autonomous spiritual self inside of ourselves that can be held accountable for our actions. And so that's where people have trouble making the jump to intelligent machines and whether they're going to be held morally accountable for their actions. But you can imagine machines getting so sophisticated that they're able to set their own goals and their own means for pursuing them, and to the point where they may even set goals that we don't understand. And at that point, the question arises as to whether they can be accountable for their actions. And it doesn't require them to have any spirit or soul or any such thing like that. It's just a consequence of the complex nature of independent agents that, in effect, have evolved minds of their own.
You have a chapter about the networking of the world and how intelligent machines might bring together the world. Are you still that optimistic given the conflicts that we're involved in now?
That's a good question. I think the answer is yes, that it can. You can imagine a communication system that really amounts to telepresence, where you can interact with other people pretty much like they're sitting there next to you. And they can remove language barriers, for example. And suppose you set up such a system where our president could talk to Saddam Hussein, you know, and they could understand each other's language and share each other's point of view. And there's a theory that that empathy with other human beings is the source of moral behavior. If you have empathy towards another person, you'll understand them better. You'll understand their worldview better, and avoid things like war, which seem to me to be totally unnecessary.
There's this view that information technology is going to empower everybody and make for an electronic democracy, and you talk about those ideas. But at the same time, there's this idea that it will empower the wealthy more and the more powerful and the militaristic more than the, you know, the working class.
Right.
Or that artificial intelligence itself might become a power to try to subjugate human beings.
Yeah.
Are you optimistic about democratic empowerment?
Technology is always a double-edged sword, you know, so it just depends on what uses we put it to. And you're right, as long as that our technology is directed towards the people who can most afford it, then there will always be haves and have-nots, and there will always be this gap that gives rise to conflicts. But I think if we put our minds to it, we could use technology and this global brain concept to bring people together.
Tom, what's the website address for the book?
The publisher's website is www.perseusbooksgroup/digitalsoul.
If people do a search for Digital Soul, they'll find
it.
That's the way I found it. I've been speaking with Dr. Tom Georges. He's the author of Digital Soul, Intelligent Machines and Human Values, available from Westview Press. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good. I appreciate your asking me to.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.